In the coming week, President Biden visits Israel, the West Bank, and Saudi Arabia. The UN Security Council discusses the conflict in Yemen, and Mexican President Andres Manuel Lopez Obrador travels to Washington. It's July 7th, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Jim Lindsay. Sitting in for Bob McMahon this week is Stephen Cook, the ENI Enrico Mattei Senior Fellow for Middle East and Africa Studies at the Council. Stephen, thanks for subbing in for Bob.
As always, it's great to be with you, Jim.
Okay, Stephen, let's get this out of the way at the beginning of our conversation. The New York Yankees are 59-23, the best record in baseball by far. So I know you're in a good
place. Don't tell anybody. You're going to jinx it.
They're up by 14 games, I believe.
Yes, they are. And I think the Yankees ownership are going to have to open the bank vaults to give to Aaron Judge to sign him and make him a Yankee for the rest of his life. I mean, we're talking like a $1 billion contract.
Okay. Well, that's not in the offering for either the two of us. So let's not dwell on Yankee salary caps and the rest, but let's talk about your area of expertise, the Middle East. Next week, President Biden makes his first trip as president to the region. He is set to stop in Israel, the West Bank, and Saudi Arabia. The trip comes just after Israel's governing coalition collapsed. Palestinians are angry at what they see as the Biden administration's failure to protest the killing of a Palestinian-American journalist. And the Saudis are still seething over Biden's vow on the campaign trail back in 2020 to make Saudi Arabia a pariah state. That doesn't sound like the ingredients for a successful trip, Stephen.
Well, there is a lot of anticipation and speculation regarding this trip. And as you point out, Jim, there are lots of traps for President Biden as he goes. The first stop, of course, is in Israel, where, as you mentioned, the government has collapsed and there is an interim prime minister, Yair Lapid. That's probably the part of the trip that's likely to go smoothest for President Biden. He will underline his ironclad commitment to Israeli security, their plans for him to visit an Iron Dome site and other places that symbolize America's longstanding commitment to Israeli security, in addition to his talks with the interim prime minister. You know, Biden has a longstanding history of being a very, very supportive of Israel, so it's not likely to be a major problem for him. He's also going to go to Bethlehem, where he'll visit the Church of the Nativity and meet with the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, who's currently in the 17th year of his four-year term. As you point out, the Palestinians are quite angry over the way in which the United States has handled the killing of the Palestinian-American journalist who worked for Al Jazeera named Shireen Abu Akla. The speculation has been that she was killed at the hands of an Israeli soldier. There hasn't been a thorough investigation of her murder. The Israelis say that they want to do their own investigation. The Palestinians have held on to the bullet. And when they did pass the bullet over to American officials, the United States almost immediately said, this is a tragic incident. It's most likely come from an Israeli rifle, but it wasn't intended. There have been calls from Congress for the FBI to get involved and do a thorough investigation, which I think is an appropriate thing under these circumstances. But nevertheless, the Palestinians are seething. Biden's argument to them is going to be, let's set this aside. I have reestablished American relations with the Palestinian Authority, which were cut off during the Trump years. The Palestinians actually cut off those ties after President Trump moved the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem and phased out funding for a variety of things that support the Palestinians. All in all, however, President Biden has evinced very little interest in the two-state solution. He'll say it. He'll say that he supports the two-state solution to the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians, but he hasn't been willing to invest in that issue much.
And why not, Stephen?
Well, you know, President Biden, when he was vice president, kind of nominally oversaw the Obama administration's efforts to foster dialogue between the Israeli government and the Palestinian Authority. And he watched, of course, over 8 years, from particular push on the part of Secretary of State John Kerry, with the help of our now colleague, Martin Indyk, Ambassador Martin Indyk, try to advanced negotiations, and then they came to naught. It seems clear that the president doesn't believe that there is a solution in the offing to the conflict. But of course, it remains American policy to support a two-state solution. I think the more interesting part of this trip is the president's visit to Saudi Arabia. First, he will fly directly from Tel Aviv to Jeddah, which is the first public flight of its kind.
And why is that significant, Stephen, for people who don't follow the ins and outs of airspace in the Middle East?
Well, of course, you know, the Saudis don't recognize Israel's existence, and you have not been able to fly in that direction before. President Trump, on his first foreign visit, he went to Saudi Arabia and he flew from Saudi Arabia to Israel. This is the first time the Saudis will be receiving an airplane directly from Israel. American officials who previously had visited Israel and Saudi Arabia would take off from Tel Aviv. Their plane would approach the airport in Amman, Jordan, descend to a certain altitude, and then ascend once again and make their way on to Saudi Arabia. So the Saudis could maintain the fiction that the flight originated in Jordan. But once he does land in Jeddah, the president will take part in a number of meetings, what's called the GCC plus three, the Gulf Cooperation Council, made up of the six members of the Gulf Cooperation Council, plus Egypt, Iraq, and Jordan. And there'll be discussion of security and economic cooperation in the region. There'll also be a meeting that he'll attend of what's called I2U2, which is Israel, India, the UAE, and the United States.
Give me that acronym again, Stephen. That seemed like a mouthful.
The administration is calling it I2U2. We're all about the acronyms, MBS, I2U2. In any event, the Indian government has been very much wanting to get involved in many of the developments coming out of the Abraham Accords. And in fact, when I was in Dubai, I was told that there's going to be the establishment of an Indian, Israeli, American, and Emirati research center established as something, you know, kind of growing out of the Abraham Accord. So there's increasing cooperation among those four governments as well. But obviously the biggest issue is everyone is anticipating the interaction between President Biden and the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman.
Well, let me just stop you right there, Stephen. Do we know for a fact that Biden is going to meet with MBS?
The administration hasn't been as clear. I have read the transcript of the phone call with unnamed senior administration official and the press and people in think tank world. And what they have said is the president will have bilateral meetings with the leadership of Saudi Arabia.
Now, the leader of Saudi Arabia is King Salman, but my understanding is he is in very ill health.
Right. The rumor has it that he's not doing well. And the administration official didn't say the leader of Saudi Arabia. Said the leadership of Saudi Arabia. So it seems likely that the president will, at the very least, have some sort of interaction with the crown prince, who he declared a pariah during his run for the White House.
This is because of the killing of the journalist Khashoggi.
That's exactly right. President Biden declared MBS a pariah. And after he came into office, he said that he would not deal with the crown prince. He would only deal with the king over the murder of the Saudi journalist who wrote a column for the Washington Post named Jamal Khashoggi, as well as, you know, the humanitarian situation in Yemen that has been made worse by the Saudi intervention in Yemen's civil war in 2015.
So are we likely to see a photo of President Biden shaking hands with the crown prince, or is this going to be no journalists allowed to take pictures?
I suspect that that has been the subject of intense negotiation, because certainly if I was the president, I would not necessarily want that photo. If you take a look at the photos of Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and the crown prince, President Erdogan
also have bad blood
over the killing of Jamal Khashoggi. And when Erdogan was forced to make amends with the Saudis and visit the kingdom, and then there was a return trip by the crown prince to Turkey, the look on Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's face was one of great satisfaction, whereas President Erdogan looked like he'd rather be anywhere but in within 10 feet of the crown prince. So I think it's a very delicate thing. There's been no indication that there will be a photo. Certainly the Saudis are going to want it. I imagine that the administration is going to want to minimize that.
So no joint press conference at the end of the conversation?
I suspect that's not going to be the case. It certainly is not something that the administration, in its kind of curtain raiser of the trip, mentioned that there would be a joint press conference.
So what is President Biden hoping to convince the Saudi leadership, which appears to be the Crown Prince MBS, to do?
Well, the visit is coming in the context of two things. One, the steep rise in oil prices as a result of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And the administration has sent emissaries to Saudi Arabia imploring them to kind of open the spigot and put more oil on the oil market to moderate prices, which would ease the pain for Americans at the pump. As it turns out, the trip is coming at a time where the price of oil is trending down. This morning, West Texas Intermediate was under $100. That was the first time in weeks that a barrel of oil is under $100. And Brent crude was just above $100. And I think, you know, people paying gas at the pump, paying attention to this, price of gas is down 10 or 11 cents a gallon over the course of the last week or so. But nevertheless, I think President Biden is going to talk to the Saudis about how they can help balance the energy market.
Can they, Stephen? Because I keep reading articles saying that global oil supplies are actually very, very tight, and the Saudis don't have the spare capacity that many Americans think they do.
That, I think that that's right. I think that the administration, though, given the political exigencies of getting the price of oil down and the problems that Americans are experiencing paying for gas, I think the administration is really wanting to be seen as doing everything that they possibly can to bring down the price of oil. Now, the Saudis are, the last I looked, were pumping 10.5 million barrels a day. They say they have a capacity of 12 million barrels a day, but that's something that they've only done once before and only for a couple of days. It's also important to remember that it is July. It's very, very hot in Saudi Arabia during the summer months, and they use a significant amount of their supply to air condition the country, which is the size of the United States east of the Mississippi. So those questions about whether the Saudis have excess capacity are valid ones. There's also an agreement among OPEC and its other partners called OPEC Plus, the most important of which is Russia, about how much oil to produce over coming months. And they meet monthly and decide on how much they're going to pump. Now, it's true that in the coming months, there is an agreement to put more oil on the market, but I think the Biden administration would like to see more of that.
So give me the bottom line, Stephen, for this trip for the Biden administration. What would have to happen for the Biden administration to be able to make the argument that this had been a successful trip? And I ask that because it comes against the backdrop of a lot of people, not just Republicans, but also many Democrats, very critical of the president's trip, particularly his going to Saudi Arabia.
Those are valid questions given the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia. And setting even aside the revulsion over the murder of Jamal Khashoggi or the situation in Yemen, I think what the administration is looking for is a number of small steps, modest steps that can be taken that as a whole can be seen as a positive. And that would include some steps on the energy markets, some steps on the Saudis towards publicly normalizing relations with Israel, not necessarily a full normalization like the Emiratis or the Bahrainis did in September 2020, but some small public steps beyond what they've already done that are kind of under the table. Some modest step or acknowledgement of human rights and responsibility for the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. But the Saudis are looking for something in return. And one of those things is going to be enhanced security cooperation with the United States. I think there's room for that, especially since the Saudis are wanting to extricate themselves for Yemen. And there's a possibility for the United States to, after, as the Saudis present themselves as the party that wants to end the conflict in Yemen, that with all of these things together, it may make it more palatable for Congress to look the other way as the administration seeks to enhance security cooperation with Saudi Arabia. And quite frankly, our other partners in the Gulf.
But what I don't hear you saying is that there's any expectation that President Biden can persuade King Salman or the Crown Prince to recognize Israel and to really expand the Abraham Accords.
Saudi Arabia is a virtual signatory to the Abraham Accords.
What does that mean?
I think the Saudis are not likely to take many more steps other than kind of discrete steps, whether it's in the fields of business or technology or defense, because there remains the Palestinian issue. And for the Saudis, that's a more important issue than arguably it is for the Emiratis or the Bahrainis or the Moroccans. So I would expect some sort of modest announcement about normalization, but I think the Israelis are really upselling here, and I don't think it's likely to happen the way they make it out to be.
Understood. Stephen, do you expect that anything is going to come out of the conversations that President Biden has in Saudi Arabia that is going to inform U.S. policy toward Yemen? I will note that next week, the UN Security Council is set to meet in New York to discuss the ongoing civil war in Yemen. It is a civil war that has created what is one of the worst humanitarian crises in the world. This at a time when the war in Ukraine is straining governments and relief agencies all around the world.
Well, I think that the administration can work with the Saudis and encourage the Saudis for the continuation of a ceasefire that has held since April, and that is set to expire in August. I think that the goal of the administration is to extricate the Saudis from this quagmire.
What do you mean by that, Stephen?
Well, the Saudis went into Yemen in 2015 expecting to defeat the Houthis, who were a party to the civil war, who had overthrown the government of Yemen and taken over the capital and perceived as a threat by the Saudis, figuring that the Saudis could intervene and get out of Yemen within months. We're now 7 years into their intervention, and it has destabilized the Arabian Peninsula. It, of course, has drawn in the Iranians who support the Houthis, and it is a costly conflict for the Saudis, not just in terms of money and materiel, but in terms of, you know, their prestige. They have contributed to a terrible humanitarian situation in Yemen. So there has been some progress. The Saudis have signaled their desire for a new political process. They've established what's called the Presidential Leadership Council. So the Biden administration can work with the UN on extending the ceasefire, which the Saudis are certainly interested in. Aid has begun to flow. There are flights now between Sana'a, the Yemeni capital, and Cairo and Amman in Jordan. But the problem, it seems, remains with the Houthis, who have, by not losing to the Saudis, have essentially won, and they have not demonstrated as much flexibility. And I think what the administration can do is continue to encourage the Saudis to work with this Presidential Leadership Council, discuss ways in which they can withdraw. But that's also going to require, the Saudis are going to ask for the United States for help with border security and anti-missile defense, because the Houthis have now the capability to fire missiles and drones at Saudi population centers.
Well, help me understand, Stephen, what the Houthis are seeking to accomplish. To what extent do they simply want to consolidate control over all of Yemen? And how much are they a proxy for the Iranians? Obviously, there's been a lot of talk about how the Houthis belong to a branch of Shia Islam. Obviously, Tehran or Qom is the center of the Shia world, though again, these are different sort of branches within that community. So to what extent are the Houthis free agents, and to what extent are they proxies?
Well, when I met the Houthis a number of years ago in Muscat,
the capital of Oman,
they said they were going to drive all the way to Riyadh. Obviously, that's not going to happen. But the Houthis have become sort of a stalking horse for the Iranians. When the Saudis intervened, they said they were intervening to prevent the Houthis from becoming a proxy of Iran and the Lebanonization of Yemen. Lebanon, which has a state within a state called Hezbollah, which is supported and supplied by the Iranians. Of course, the Saudi intervention had made those things actually reality. So they've driven the Houthis closer to the Iranians. I think what the Houthis want to do is to dominate Yemen. And it's something that's going to make the Saudis uncomfortable, but there's really nothing that they can do about it at this point because of their military mistakes have emboldened and empowered the Houthis and have encouraged the Iranians to support them.
In what percentage, more or less, are Houthis of the overall population of Yemen?
The Houthis, it's a group of people. They're following someone named Houthi, who are part of the Shia branch of Islam. It's not actually such a huge group. You know, we're talking about what was a kind of multifaceted civil war that was happening on Saudi Arabia's borders. So, but the Houthis, by dint of Saudi incompetence, the central government of Yemen's incompetence, and support from Iran, have been effective fighters in the field and now control the Yemeni capital and other large parts of the country.
Have there been any efforts by the United States to try to build relations with the Houthi leadership, or is that considered to be a no-go, both because of the ties with Iran and because the Saudis are so dead set against the Houthis coming to power in Yemen?
Undoubtedly, we have no idea what is happening, you know, what intelligence agencies are doing and who they're...
There may be secret conversations, but they're not open
conversations. Maybe secret conversations through the good offices of the Omanis, but there hasn't been a direct American diplomatic outreach to the Houthis. We've been working through the UN special envoy. The United States has its own envoy that are seeking to bring this terrible conflict to an end. We're also talking about, you know, this part of the kind of fraught nature of U.S.-Saudi relations is the Saudi perception that the United States isn't committed to Saudi security in ways that it had perhaps previously been or perceived to have previously been. And a direct American outreach to the Houthis would, I think, sow further mistrust between Riyadh and Washington.
Fair enough.
Well, Jim, let's take our conversation out of the Middle East and back to the Americas. President Biden will host Mexico's President Andres Manuel López Obrador next Tuesday, the day before Biden begins his Middle East trip. These two leaders appear to have an icy relationship with AMLO, as he is known, recently boycotting the Summit of the Americas that the Biden administration hosted in Los Angeles. What will the two leaders be talking about?
Well, Stephen, the two leaders are going to discuss a range of issues, things like economic cooperation, food security, possibly Ukraine. But obviously, a big issue is going to be the topic of immigration or migration across the U.S. southern border. As you point out, the two do not have a warm relationship. I think the discussions that we're going to have next Tuesday are likely to be correct but icy. The two leaders don't have any sort of personal chemistry. Their worldviews are very different. And as you noted, AMLO has no problem standing up to Washington. He boycotted the Biden signature Summit of the Americas conference because he was protesting the refusal by the Biden administration to invite Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua to the meeting. I think from the vantage point of Washington, there's great concern about the direction that Mexico is going. We've seen stories recently that have highlighted the deterioration of the security situation across Mexico during AMLO's presidency. I think from the vantage point of the United States, there's also great concern about the direction the Mexican economy is going. There was an excellent piece in the Financial Times recently documenting the downturn in the Mexican economy as AMLO has pursued these nationalist protectionist policies that have really undermined the Mexican economy and forfeited the opportunity that Mexico had to take advantage of this decoupling between the United States and China. Many people had expected that jobs would go from China to Mexico, but instead they've gone to places like Indonesia, Vietnam, and the rest. And that's largely because of the protectionist policies that AMLO has pursued. And likewise, President López Obrador has really sort of dialed back what had been an opening in the Mexican energy sector. Several years ago, there was an amendment to the Mexican Constitution to allow Mexico to go away from its very state-directed energy sector. Mexico's a big producer, or was a big producer of oil, and AMLO has dialed that back. There's been a great deal of concern north of the border about those decisions and what they will mean for the long-term future. A number of specific instances in which the American government has taken actions against American companies that Washington is upset about. On the flip side, you have, you know, AMLO is going to talk about one of his big issues, which is he wants to create a system that would regularize the flow of Mexican workers into the United States. This has been a longstanding objective of many Mexican governments, and because of our complicated immigration politics, we haven't gotten very far in that score.
What's striking to me is that, you know, it seemed like during the Trump administration, there really had been a kind of reversion to kind of difficult relations between the United States and Mexico that were something of, you know, decades prior. And there was a certain expectation that when President Biden came into office that that would change and that the relationship would get back on track. But instead, it seems to have continued to deteriorate.
Well, in a way, under Trump, U.S.-Mexican relations smoothed out once AMLO became president halfway through the Trump presidency because they have a similar world outlook, let's say. And President Trump was not inclined to demand anything of Mexico on the human rights front or in other issues that have been particular sore points in U.S.-Mexican relations. He simply said to López Obrador, I want you to do what you can to keep people from coming across the border. So in some sense, they understood each other. Of course, you get to a Biden administration, which is talking about issues like human rights and economic development and democracy. And all of a sudden, you have leaders who are basically not on the same page. And you see that in the summit of the Americas and boycotting there. You see it in differences over what Mexico is doing on its energy policy and the like. And so there's not a real meeting of the minds, which is why I expect this is going to be a conversation that is going to be correct. I assume all diplomatic protocols will be followed, but I don't anticipate any meeting of the minds, any big decisions being reached. And of course, you know, there's that issue out there, Ukraine, which the Biden administration has been trying to get countries around the world to take a strong position against the Russian aggression. Mexico has refused to do that. And indeed, AMLO has called NATO's policies toward Ukraine immoral. So again, this is not a conversation between two leaders who see the world in similar ways, even if they come from neighboring countries.
Right. Although AMLO's position on Ukraine is not atypical of a variety of parts of the world. Well, Jim, I think it's time to pivot and discuss our audience figure of the week, which listeners can vote on or tweet us at CFR.org. This week, Jim, our audience selected "More British Officials Resign." Now, Jim, you were just in the UK. Why is this the audience figure of the week?
Well, I suspect, Stephen, that when our listeners were voting on this on our Twitter poll, that what they had in mind were the large number of senior British officials who had resigned from the government of Boris Johnson. What they didn't have in mind is something that came true between when the poll went out and when we sat down here to tape it, which is that Prime Minister Johnson has announced that he is going to step down as prime minister. He is stepping down immediately as the leader of the Conservative Party. He is hoping to stay on as prime minister until such time that the Conservative Party picks a new leader. It's unclear how long that will take. It's unclear whether Conservative Party members are going to allow Johnson to stay in office. Now, again, keep in mind the way the British system works is that a prime minister can step down, but you don't necessarily have new elections immediately. The Conservatives still control a majority in the House of Commons. So if they pick a new prime minister, he or she will step into 10 Downing Street and the government will continue. And the question is, how long is that going to take? And would a new prime minister decide to call new elections, something a prime minister can do? The immediate trigger for Johnson's resignation is a controversy that arose in the last 2 weeks over a senior Conservative Party lawmaker who allegedly groped two other lawmakers in a bar. The Conservative lawmaker in question was intoxicated. Johnson expressed surprise that this had happened. Stories then came out that the official in question had a record of this. Johnson denied that he knew anything about it. Then it came out, it turned out he did know about it and still had appointed this individual to a senior position. And that was sort of enough is enough for the rest of the Conservative Party. And they began deserting him in droves. But it takes place against the backdrop of Johnson's leadership style, which had been shambolic, if I can use that word, in which he had seemed to have leapt from controversy to controversy, typically by denying anything had happened, then granting something had happened, but nobody had reason to know otherwise, to eventually admitting to all of the criticisms that his critics had leveled. So we're now going to find out who's going to be the British Prime Minister. He or she is going to have his or her hands full. Just based on my conversations in London last week, Brexit is not delivering the immediate economic bounce that people spoke about. People are worried about the consequences of the Ukraine war, inflation, and the rest. So it's, I think, an uneasy time in Great Britain these days.
Well, indeed, I think the now former Prime Minister Boris Johnson has an odd relationship.
I don't think he's former Prime Minister yet. He's hoping to stay on.
Well, that's true. Former leader of the Conservative Party.
He may be former prime minister by the time this episode airs, given the speed with which this is developing. So
he does have an odd relationship with the truth. And thank you, Jim, for explaining how this will all work in terms of whether there will be new elections. This was actually the conversation at the breakfast table at my home this morning about what would happen. But more importantly,
you have much more intellectual conversations around the breakfast table than I do. Usually I'm asking, where did I leave my iPhone?
Well, it wasn't initiated by me. It was initiated by my older daughter, who was curious as to what would happen next. I will say I've spoken to a number of people who've been in the UK recently, and they've expressed grave concern about what Brexit has really done to the country. And they say that they really see the echoes of, you know, Britain and the British crisis of the 1970s reemerging in the country. And that I think there's gross underestimation of how the EU membership being part of Europe created to the kind of contributed to the dynamism of the British economy over the course of the last, you know, three or four decades.
Well, you're right to flag that, Stephen, and there is the issue of where the United Kingdom is going to go and whether the United Kingdom will actually remain intact. Recently, Nicola Sturgeon, who is the First Minister of Scotland, announced that she wants to hold a referendum in October of 2023 about Scotland leaving the United Kingdom. Boris Johnson had said he was not going to agree to such a referendum. We'll see what happens on that score. But you have the whole Scottish, English, Scottish, rest of the United Kingdom issue. But you also have the question of the future of Northern Ireland. Again, one of the consequences of the United Kingdom leaving the European Union is the question of where the border would be between the United Kingdom and the European Union, particularly as it relates to Northern Ireland. You may recall the Good Friday Agreement, which helped end the troubles there, rests on the assumption that you will have an open border between Northern Ireland and Ireland. But when the United Kingdom left the EU, the question is, do you put a hard border between Northern Ireland and Ireland, which would violate the Good Friday Agreement? Or do you put a border down the Irish Sea, essentially basically separating Northern Ireland from the rest of the United Kingdom? And there's no simple way out of that conundrum. And that is something that had been bedeviling the Johnson government. And the new prime minister is going to have to deal with that.
Well, it is really one of those things that you look back on the Brexit referendum and David Cameron going to referendum without knowing the answer beforehand.
Well, I think he thought he knew what the answer would be. He thought that they were going to get credit for having held the referendum. The Remain ticket would win and they could say to their constituents, we tried, it didn't work. Now we're going to have to find ways to make the EU work better for Great Britain. Instead, they became the dog that caught the bumper of the car and had to deal with it.
In fact, Boris Johnson had written two things, one in support of remaining and one in support of leaving the European Union. And when the writing was on the wall, he came out in support of leaving for only his parochial political interest. Quite an extraordinary story that's likely to unfold for the rest of the summer and beyond in the UK.
That is certainly the case, Stephen. And that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. The German Social Democratic Party will meet to decide whether to expel former Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder over his failure to cut his ties to Russia. And the United Nations will launch its newest Sustainable Development Goals report. Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. The articles, books, and podcasts mentioned in this episode are listed on the podcast page for The World Next Week on CFR.org. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Rafaela Seward with senior producer Gabrielle Sierra. Rafaela did double duty as our recording engineer. Thank you, Rafaela. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. Special thanks go out to Margaret Gatch, John David Cobb, and Morme Zanke for their assistance. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Stephen Cook saying so long.